He was born in the fire, not of fame, but of gunshots and ghetto cries. In a Kingston torn apart by politics and poverty, a boy named Rodney Price would rise, not with peace, but with power. They called him Bounty Killer, the warlord of dance hall, a lyrical soldier whose voice cracked like thunder across Jamaica's troubled streets. From the sound systems of Seaview Gardens to sold-out European arenas, Bounty didn't just spit lyrics, he declared war on silence. Rivalries weren't just for the stage, they were survival. And his verses? They were bullets aimed at injustice, betrayal, and hypocrisy. But this isn't just a story of battles. It's a journey from street chaos to global redemption. From Beanie Man clashes to building the Alliance, from being banned to being honored, Bounty Killer's story is a rebellion wrapped in rhythm. This is the untold truth behind the warlord of dancehall, and the legacy that roared louder than fear. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Born into fire, the making of Rodney Basil Price. Kingston, Jamaica. The year is 1972. The island is tense, divided, and vibrating with danger. Gunshots echo in the night. Politicians speak in promises by day and arm the youth by dusk. The country, though barely a decade into its independence from Britain, is already spiraling into a new form of warfare. One fought not on distant battlefields, but in backyards, alleys, and tenement yards. And in the heart of Seaview Gardens, a tough, working-class neighborhood in West Kingston, a child is born. His name, Rodney Basil Price. From the very beginning, Rodney's life was surrounded by volatility. Not just from the wider politics of Jamaica, but from the daily unpredictability of the ghetto. Zinc fences rattling in the wind, power cuts in the night, and sudden gunfire that could erupt without warning. But within that storm, Rodney was raised by a force of nature, Miss Ivy, his mother. Miss Ivy was a woman of substance, steel, and spirit. A Seventh-day Adventist, she raised 9 children with unwavering faith, dignity, and discipline, despite being surrounded by crime and chaos. She sold provisions, washed clothes, and prayed daily, not just for survival, but for transformation. Rodney, the 5th of her children, was sharp, observant, and restless. He wasn't the loudest, but his eyes took in everything. By the early 1980s, Jamaica had become a war zone. The rivalry between the People's National Party, PNP, and the Jamaica Labor Party, JLP, had turned neighborhoods into front lines. Guns flowed like rum. And the children of the ghetto, bright, talented, desperate, were often caught in the middle. Some chose the gun. Others chose music. Rodney, he would eventually choose both, but not in the way most expected. At just 14 years old, Rodney was shot during a violent incident near his home. The bullet didn't kill him, but it forever changed him. He later described it as the moment when the boy died and something else, something harder, hungrier, and less afraid, was born. He renamed himself Bounty Hunter, later stylized as Bounty Killer. The ghetto had given him a wound. He would turn it into a weapon, a voice. He began to write. Not poetry, but warfare and rhyme. He mimicked the sound system giants of his youth, Josie Wales, Super Cat, Papa San, Brigadier Jerry, men who spat lyrics like sermons over pounding rhythms. Rodney, however, didn't just want to entertain. He wanted to warn, expose, and dominate. His big break came in the late 1980s, when he caught the attention of King Jammy, one of dancehall's most respected producers. Jammy, known for launching stars like Shabba Ranks and Admiral Bailey, saw something raw in Rodney's voice, a guttural aggression that didn't need polishing. It needed unleashing. Under Jammy's guidance, Bounty Killer dropped early tracks like Coppershot, Spy Fi Die, and Kill Fay Fun. Violent in sound, but grounded in the harsh realities of ghetto survival. These were not imaginary tales. They were testimonies. The streets recognized their own. A new warlord had arrived. But it wasn't all blood and bullets. Beneath the hardness, Rodney was highly intelligent, politically aware, and deeply spiritual. Raised on Bible verses and street codes alike, he understood contradictions, and he used them. As Bounty Killer, he could one day release a track denouncing poverty, poor people fed up, and the next day clash lyrically with rivals over gun lyrics. To some, it was hypocrisy. To others, it was genius. To Bounty, it was survival. By the early 1990s, Bounty Killer was no longer just a name on a flyer. He was a movement. Dancehall was changing, moving from slackness and party vibes to something more militant, more street, more real. And no one embodied that shift more than him. He wore dark shades, spoke in short, clipped phrases, and rarely smiled. On stage, he was volcanic. In interviews, he was cryptic. But behind closed doors, he was methodical, reading newspapers daily, discussing politics, and obsessing over the failures of Jamaican leadership. As he climbed the ladder of stardom, he never left Seaview Gardens, not in spirit, not in speech. He reminded his fans constantly, "Me na come from uptown. Me na have rich fada. Me na have nutten fancy. Me just have me voice and me pain." This was the foundation. This was the fire. Before the feuds. Before the alliance. Before Verzuz and redemption. There was a boy from Seaview who survived a bullet and decided to speak louder than the system. Bounty Killer wasn't created in a studio. He was forged in the furnace of Kingston's war. Clash culture, Beanie Man, war lyrics, and the rise of a warlord. By the early 1990s, Bounty Killer was no longer just a ghetto sensation. He was a national disruptor. His voice, gravel-lined and defiant, had become the pulse of a generation raised on hardship, distrust, and daily confrontation. And in the world of dancehall, confrontation was not just lyrical, it was cultural currency. Jamaican dancehall had always thrived on competition. Sound clashes, where sound systems battled for supremacy, were the lifeblood of the scene. DJs didn't just sing for admiration. They fought for dominance. And in this brutal, no-holds-barred arena, Bounty Killer emerged as a gladiator. His rise coincided with another force in the dancehall universe, Beanie Man, the youthful prodigy turned charismatic showman. Beanie was smooth, lyrical, and deeply rooted in performance art. Bounty was rough, militant, and unfiltered. Their differences weren't just artistic, they were ideological. Beanie represented flair. Bounty represented fire. Their rivalry began subtly, veiled deces, strategic interviews, subliminal lines and songs. But in Jamaica, where fans are tribal and allegiances run deep, those sparks quickly turned into wildfires. It was at Sting 1993, Jamaica's most infamous stage for lyrical warfare, that the tension reached a boiling point. Though they didn't clash directly that night, their presence electrified the air. Fans began to take sides. Was Beanie Man the crown prince of dancehall? Or was Bounty Killer the true voice of the people? The following year, Bounty released Lodge, a scathing track that took aim at secret societies, uptown hypocrisy, and some believed, his rivals in the industry. It was unapologetic and dangerous, and it became an anthem. Around the same time, Beanie responded with Bad Man Wicked Man, which many saw as a direct shot at Bounty. The media stoked the flames. Every interview, every dancehall stage, every dubplate was scrutinized. Fans turned dances into battlegrounds, not of violence, but of loyalty. Sound system selectors wielded dubplates like machetes, pitting Bounty's, not another word, against Beanie's world dance. But unlike other musical rivalries, this one had a raw undercurrent. It wasn't just entertainment. It was personal. Both men came from poverty. Both fought for relevance. But only one could stand as the king of the streets. Bounty responded with Kill or Be Killed, followed by Mama, a heartfelt tribute to Miss Ivy that reminded fans he wasn't just a warlord, he was a son, a survivor, a soul. The juxtaposition was powerful. Beanie dazzled with commercial hits. Bounty bled truth on every track. Their feud reached critical mass at Sting 1995, where the long-awaited face-off finally took place. The two giants met on stage, trading lines, postures, threats, and roars from the crowd. It wasn't a clean battle. Accusations of sabotage and sound distortion surfaced, but what mattered most was clear. The culture was alive, and Bounty Killer had solidified his place as the ultimate clash artist. But the war of lyrics came with consequences. Corporate Jamaica grew wary. International promoters hesitated. Bounty was often painted by the media as aggressive, uncooperative, and dangerous. While Beanie Man received mainstream endorsements and wider crossover success, Bounty remained in the trenches, respected, feared, but not always welcomed. Still, he stayed true to his mission. In 1996, Bounty dropped the critically acclaimed album, My Experience, a raw, haunting body of work that featured Jeru the Dimaja, Raekwon, and the Fugees Wyclef Jean. It fused dancehall with hardcore hip-hop, giving Bounty global exposure while keeping him grounded in Jamaican grit. One standout track, Fed Up, became a generational rallying cry. With chilling precision, Bounty detailed the frustrations of the urban poor, lambasting corrupt politicians, ineffective leadership, and systemic neglect. It was more than a song. It was a manifesto. The ghetto had a new national anthem, and Bounty Killer was its prophet. As the decade progressed, the Beanie Bounty rivalry would ebb and flow. Clashes continued, songs flew back and forth, but something deeper was happening. Both artists, now veterans, began to evolve, musically, emotionally, and publicly. And while fans still debated who won the battles, there was no denying that both men had elevated the culture. Yet for Bounty, the war wasn't over. He had built his name through lyrical confrontation, but now he set his sights on something even bigger, building an empire. The next chapter would mark the birth of the Alliance, and Bounty's transformation from a solo warrior into a mentor of the next generation of dancehall's most fearsome voices. But before that, one truth remained. In a culture built on fire, only the boldest survived. And Bounty Killer wasn't just surviving, he was rewriting the rules. The Alliance, Bounty Killer as architect of a generation. By the early 2000s, Bounty Killer had conquered the clash arenas and cemented his place as dancehall's most feared lyricist. But the warlord was no longer satisfied with personal glory. He had seen what fame could do, how it consumed artists, divided communities, and burned bridges in the name of ego. So he made a decision that would forever alter the landscape of Jamaican music. He became a builder. Out of the streets of Kingston rose the Alliance. Not a label, not a crew, but a movement. And at its center was Bounty Killer, now shifting into the role of general, mentor, and cultural gatekeeper. The Alliance wasn't born in boardrooms or marketing meetings. It was forged in studios, backyards, and stage shows, grounded in respect and lyrical skill. Bounty saw untapped fire in the new generation. Instead of competing with them, he gave them guidance, visibility, and most importantly, protection. The first name to emerge under Bounty's watch was a young, wild, electrifying performer with bleach blonde hair and a voice like thunder, Elephant Man. ELE was raw energy, dancehall's answer to a supernova. But it was Bounty who gave him structure. Bounty who taught him timing, tone, and stage discipline. Elephant would later describe Bounty Killer not just as a mentor, but as a father in the business. Next came Vibes Cartel, a lyrical genius from Portmore with a pen dipped in gasoline. Cartel's metaphors were layered, his wit unmatched, and his hunger for the crown unrelenting. Bounty saw it immediately. He brought Cartel into the fold, even when others doubted his eccentric style. Together, they ruled the airwaves, until Cartel would eventually outgrow the Alliance and go rogue. But the seed was Bounty's. Then came Busy Signal, Wayne Marshall, Movado, voices that would define a new era of dancehall. Each unique, each powerful, and all carrying DNA from the warlord himself. But the rise of the Alliance wasn't just about music, it was about strategy. Bounty knew the system wouldn't welcome ghetto youth, so he created his own system. He controlled rhythms. He curated performances. He orchestrated radio rotations and stage pairings. He used his name not to dominate, but to elevate. In interviews, Bounty was clear. Me na fight dem youth ya. Me a build dem. A so de music live on. Yet, even within the Alliance, tension brewed. The very thing that made the Alliance powerful, its strong personalities, also made it combustible. Cartel and Movado eventually clashed, creating one of the most divisive rivalries in dancehall history. Bounty tried to intervene, tried to mediate. But like a father watching sons go to war, his influence could only stretch so far. The public began to question, was Bounty losing control? Was the Alliance collapsing under its own weight? But Bounty never panicked. He understood that growth came with rebellion. He had once been the rebel himself. Now, he let his students learn the hard way, just as he had. Behind the scenes, Bounty remained a moral compass. When artists veered too far into glorifying gun culture, he pulled them aside. When labels tried to exploit the genre, he spoke out. And when dancehall faced criticism for homophobia and violent lyrics, Bounty, though often controversial himself, was one of the few veterans who began to publicly evolve his message. He started to distance himself from the shock tactics of the 90s. His lyrics became more reflective, his interviews more measured. He spoke openly about politics, poverty, and corruption, not just as a DJ, but as a Jamaican citizen. Meanwhile, international artists were watching. Busta Rhymes, The Fugees, No Doubt, Pharrell, and Swizz Beatz all collaborated with or credited Bounty Killer as a foundational voice in dancehall's global crossover. In hip-hop circles, he was revered, not just for his flow, but for his principle. Back home, even amid shifting trends and rising stars, Bounty Killer remained a pillar. He wasn't always on the charts, but he was always in the conversation. His voice still echoed through sound systems. His legacy was now embedded in the DNA of nearly every major act in the genre. And yet, he remained grounded. He stayed in Jamaica. He still visited Seaview Gardens. He still showed up for funerals, community events, and school fundraisers. Fame never disconnected him from reality. If anything, it made him more responsible. The warlord had become the architect. The clash champion had become the foundation. In an industry known for betrayal and ego, Bounty Killer had built a legacy based on loyalty, integrity, and power shared, not hoarded. But the story was far from over. In the next chapter, Bounty would face new challenges, personal, legal, and artistic, as Jamaica itself changed and the world began to reevaluate dancehall's place in the global cultural conversation. And yet, through every fire, Bounty Killer remained. Not just a survivor, but a standard. Controversy, censorship, and the battle for dancehall's soul. By the mid-2000s, Bounty Killer stood as both a national icon and a public lightning rod. Revered by dancehall purists and ghetto youths, yet vilified by social conservatives and international watchdogs, he was no longer just an artist. He had become a symbol of rebellion, of resistance, and to some, of the moral crisis facing Jamaican culture. Dancehall, by then, was under siege. The genre's raw energy, once celebrated as authentic and revolutionary, was being dissected in global headlines. International media accused it of glorifying violence, promoting homophobia, and corrupting youth. At the center of that storm stood one of its loudest voices, Bounty Killer. His lyrics were under fire. His interviews, often defiant and unfiltered, became tabloid fodder. But to understand this chapter of Bounty's journey, one must understand the paradox that lived within him, the street preacher and the cultural arsonist. In Jamaica, Bounty's songs weren't just music, they were truth. When he DJed about police brutality, poverty, or political betrayal, he was voicing the lived experience of thousands. Tracks like Poor People Fed Up, Look Into My Eyes, and Suffer weren't just bangers, they were anthems of protest. But with that rawness came lyrics about guns, gang loyalty, and most controversially, sexuality. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, international human rights groups like Outrage and Stop Murder Music began targeting dancehall artists, accusing them of inciting violence against the LGBTQ+ community. Bounty Killer's name was frequently included in those campaigns. Concerts were canceled across Europe. Promoters faced pressure to drop him. Some venues banned his music altogether. Bounty's response, characteristically unapologetic. In interviews, he defended the genre's cultural context. He argued that dancehall was being judged without understanding the lived realities it sprang from. Dem want me shut up, he once said. But me nah silence me voice fi please Babylon. Yet behind the bravado, the controversy had real consequences. Tour income declined, endorsements vanished, and even within Jamaica, the debate intensified. Was Bounty Killer a cultural defender or a reckless provocateur? Ironically, it was around this same time that Bounty began showing signs of transformation. He appeared at schools, warning youth about the traps of violence and gang life. He spoke at conferences about the responsibility of artists. He donated to community programs and advocated for the proper management of Jamaican music rights. In 2006, at the funeral of Father Holung's Missionaries of the Poor director, Bounty stood in quiet reflection. It was a moment rarely seen, the warlord in white, surrounded by nuns and gospel choirs. Not a stage, not a clash, just silence, reflection, grace. But even as his public persona evolved, legal troubles followed. In 2010, he was arrested for assault after an alleged domestic dispute. The case was later dropped, but it stained his reputation during a time when the world was becoming increasingly sensitive to issues of gender-based violence. That same year, he was arrested again, this time for marijuana possession and using profane language in public, a minor charge by dancehall standards, but a reminder of the constant surveillance he lived under. Despite the controversies, Bounty's artistry never faded. He continued to release tracks that blended aggression with introspection. Songs like Corrupt and Ghetto Dictionary reminded fans that while others chased hype, he remained rooted in purpose. Meanwhile, younger artists who once clashed with him, including Vybz Kartel, began echoing some of his early criticisms of the system. The student had become the philosopher, and the warlord had become a mirror for the very culture he helped build. By 2016, a different conversation was unfolding. Was Bounty Killer Jamaica's most misunderstood artist? The man who once clashed with the entire industry was now being seen as one of its few remaining truth-tellers. In an emotional onstage moment, Bounty Killer declared, "Me nah sing Nut 10 again fi mash up de place. Me day off I build." The crowd roared. But beneath the applause was a deeper recognition. Bounty had changed. The same voice that once terrorized sound clashes and shattered speakers was now demanding accountability, infrastructure, and respect for dancehall. He began mentoring again, not just in music, but in life. He spoke publicly about mental health, about redemption, and about outliving the hype. The warlord, it seemed, was no longer battling rivals. He was battling the image the world had painted of him. And he was winning. But nothing would prepare the world for what came next: a global pandemic, an unlikely reunion, and the moment that redefined his legacy for a new generation. Verzuz, Redemption in the Time of Lockdown. May 23, 2020. The world was locked indoors. The streets of Kingston were quieter than anyone could remember. Globally, concerts were canceled, borders closed, stages silenced. But in that stillness, in the middle of a pandemic that had stolen so much joy, something extraordinary happened. Two giants of dancehall met not in a clash, but in a celebration. Bounty Killer and Beanie Man. On one screen. One mic. One moment that would become legendary. This was Verzuz, a digital music battle series launched by producers Swizz Beatz and Timbaland to keep the culture alive during lockdown. Originally meant to highlight American hip-hop and R&B legends, the idea took an unexpected and electrifying Caribbean turn. When Bounty Killer and Beanie Man were announced as the next showdown, fans braced for fireworks. The two had defined the art of dancehall rivalry, clashing from the early 90s, igniting stages and splitting fan bases. But this time felt different. The anticipation wasn't about beef. It was about legacy. And that night, they delivered something greater than a clash. They delivered unity. Streaming live from Kingston with over 500,000 real-time viewers and millions more watching after, the two icons took turns dropping classic after classic. Look Into My Eyes, Who Am I, Fed Up, Girls Dem Sugar, Living Dangerously, and more. But it wasn't just the music. It was the energy, the chemistry, the respect. Bounty Killer, dressed in full black with military precision, was serious but smiling. His baritone cuts through the speakers with sharpness and clarity, but behind every lyric was a man reclaiming his story. Gone was the shadow of controversy. Gone was the stereotype of the angry warlord. What stood before the world was a master of craft, a foundational pillar of global black music culture, and a man who had outlived the streets, the criticism, and the doubt. The highlight came midstream when Jamaican police entered the studio, citing noise complaints and curfew violations. Beanie, ever the performer, diffused the tension with charm, while Bounty stood firm, calm, composed, present. The internet erupted. Memes flooded in. Tweets poured out. Major outlets from Rolling Stone to BBC to Billboard hailed the Verzuz as the most entertaining, the most powerful, and the most authentic of the entire series. But beneath the entertainment was something far deeper. Bounty Killer had undergone a public redemption, not through apology, but through artistry. He reminded the world that dancehall was not noise, not scandal, not violence. It was power, poetry, and purpose, and he had carried it for decades. In the days that followed, streams of his music surged. Youth who had never witnessed his rise were now discovering his catalog. New fans in Nigeria, the UK, the US, and Brazil began to dive into the ghetto dictionary. The warlord had crossed another line, not of beef, but of time. And Bounty knew it. In post-Verzuz interviews, he spoke differently. He thanked Beanie. He thanked the fans. He even thanked his critics, saying they had sharpened him. He used his platform to talk about mental health, community development, the failures of Jamaican leadership, and the need for artists to own their publishing and platforms. More collaborations followed. New features, a revitalized tour schedule. And yet, through it all, Bounty remained grounded. He still rolled with his small team. He still gave back in Seaview. He still corrected radio hosts who got their facts wrong. He was older, wiser, but no less dangerous, just in a different way. His voice was now a tool not just for clashing, but for clarity. In many ways, Verzuz wasn't just a moment. It was a mirror, one that reflected everything Bounty Killer had endured, fought, and ultimately transformed. He had started as a child survivor of a gunshot wound. He became a voice of the ghetto, a warlord of dancehall, a mentor to giants, a critic of corruption, a symbol of strength, and in lockdown, when the world needed light, he became what few expected, a hero. Legacy and Lionheart, the unshakable impact of Bounty Killer. Legends aren't born. They're carved by pressure, fire, and time. And Rodney Basil Price, better known to the world as Bounty Killer, is one of Jamaica's most enduring monuments. This is no longer the story of a DJ from Seaview Gardens. This is the legacy of a man who redefined an entire genre, nurtured generations, and stood unwavering through controversy, censorship, betrayal, and global recognition. Legacy for Bounty Killer isn't about awards or magazine covers. It's about impact, and his fingerprints are everywhere. You hear it in the militant cadence of Movado, the lyrical acrobatics of Vibes Cartel, the raw electricity of Busy Signal, and the unapologetic swagger of Elephant Man. Every major artist who emerged in the 2000s and beyond owes something, whether directly or through influence, to the blueprint laid by the warlord. But Bounty's influence extends far beyond sound. In a country where politicians often abandon the people after elections, Bounty has remained. He is a constant in the chaos, calling out corruption, questioning leadership, and reminding Jamaica's elite that the ghetto has a voice. He has never left Seaview Gardens. Despite global tours, international fame, and cosigns from artists like Busta Rhymes, Swizz Beatz, and Wyclef Jean, Bounty still walks the streets where it all began. He gives back quietly, covering funeral costs, donating school supplies, sponsoring community events, and mentoring youth behind the scenes. He doesn't always post it. He doesn't need to, because legacy is what people say about you when you're not in the room. And in Kingston, the name Bounty Killer is said with reverence. He is not without flaws, and he never pretends otherwise. His past is riddled with arrests, beefs, backlash, and moments of explosive defiance. But therein lies the power of his arc. Bounty Killer has never hidden his evolution. He has lived it out loud, in full view of the people, and in doing so, given permission to others to grow too. In recent years, Bounty has focused heavily on ownership and education within the music industry. He advocates for young artists to retain their publishing, understand contracts, and study the business side of their art. For a man once painted as a street warlord, he now operates like a professor of culture, schooling both the industry and the youth. In 2021, he launched the Bounty Foundation, aimed at providing support to hospitals, inner-city communities, and underserved youth. It's not just charity, it's structure, sustainability, and a vision for a better Jamaica. He remains a voice of warning and a voice of hope, issuing cautionary bars on tracks like Miss Ivy Last Sun, while also standing as a mentor, gatekeeper, an advocate for peace in a genre that often glamorizes war. When Beanie Man was hospitalized, Bounty visited. When dancehall artists are jailed or fall into depression, he speaks up. When the government fails to protect the poor, he speaks out. He has become more than dancehall. He is now a national voice of conscience. And yet, through all of it, he is still the man who enters a studio, grabs the mic, and delivers thunder. Still the man who can bring a crowd of 10,000 to their feet with one phrase. Cross, angry, miserable. In the end, Bounty Killer's legacy is layered. He is the Clash King, the Ghetto Prophet, the Mentor, the Rebel, the Redeemer, the Lion with a heart made not of gold, but of granite. From surviving a bullet at 14 to conquering Verzuz in lockdown, from Seaview to the world and back again, his story is not just about music. It is about resilience, reinvention, and responsibility. And long after the rhythms fade and the clashes quiet, one truth will remain. Bounty Killer didn't just live dancehall. He became its spine.